Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And we are back. It's the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Paul Smith. So far as I know, we are not related. But Paul is a remote viewer, and not just a remote viewer. He's one of the pioneers of remote viewing. And Paul is also the person who wrote the manual for the remote viewing program that our U.S. government was engaged in. Paul, it's been a while since you were with us, but welcome back to the show.
Thanks. I'm always happy to be on with you.
Paul, that program passed around. It was at one point, now it was called the Stargate program, but at one point it was CIA was in charge of it. At one point, I think the Air Force was in charge of it. The U.S. Army, I think, had command of it for a while. What's the story on that? How did that get passed around?
Well, it got passed around when folks, kind of like the folks that are running CNN, it sounds like, decided that they didn't believe in any of the stuff that was being done, and they got rid of it with extreme prejudice. And then some other agency with some forward-thinking folks picked it up for a while until people got in charge in those organizations who thought it was a bunch of baloney too, and then they got rid of it. Kind of got bounced around like that. It's actually quite an interesting story, kind of complicated, but I do tell about it in my book. So if anybody has my book, they can read that and see all the ins and outs and the vicissitudes of the remote viewing program.
When you got involved with this, I believe you were a captain, is that right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then by the time you got out, you were a major, so you were... were you still in the program when you were a major?
No, I had gotten promoted, but the way it works in the Army, you get promoted first, so you pin on the rank later. So I was what they call a promotable captain. And I got moved out of the program a little bit early because of Desert Storm, and I'd had the... I guess you could say good luck to be an Arabic linguist in my enlisted days, and Desert Storm broke, and they needed everybody, anybody and everybody who had a background in the Middle East, and so I got sent to the 101st Airborne Division and got to go have a ringside seat to a very short but interesting war.
Well, as I do with all of the folks that come on this show who have served our country, I want to thank you for your service, and I mean that, and it is truly appreciated. You know, we sit here and talk tonight and are free to do so because of your service and the service of many other folks like you who made sacrifices to make sure that we stayed free, and I appreciate it.
Well, you know, I and folks like me... that really makes us feel that what we did was worthwhile. You know, obviously we had our own reasons too, but I can't think of a better constituency to be serving than the American public.
Yeah. Paul, the last time you were on, we talked about remote viewing in general. We talked about what it is. And I think many folks in our audience, probably most of the audience, are familiar with what remote viewing is. However, I think what we need to do is we need to, you know, just sort of review that and make sure that that folks just kind of have a definition in their minds of what remote viewing is.
Yeah, well, remote viewing is actually a skill that takes advantage of an underlying capability that every human seems to have, which generally in our vernacular we call psychic ability or paranormal ability or ESP or whatever. Everybody seems to have that ability innately, but most people don't even know they do, and most people don't use it. And some researchers discovered that you could teach people how to access that and then take advantage of it and practice it and get better at it over time, get more reliable, and actually do something with it, right? And that skill is called remote viewing. It's the ability to basically perceive things that are hidden from you if you're doing it, either like being on the other side of the world or being in a locked room or sealed in an envelope or whatever it may be, and do it and perceive those things with only the power of your own mind. So it really is a form of ESP in a way, but it's kind of a disciplined or a controlled version of it, you could say.
And that's something we talked about last time, and I think is important. You, obviously, one of the real insiders on remote viewing, because, I mean, you've been there virtually from the start. You say that in a way it is a psychic ability. There are other remote viewers, some of them big names, that say it's not psychic. Why do you say it is a psychic ability?
Well, because that's the word that most people understand. And the ones who say it isn't psychic, that, you know, the leading remote viewers you're talking about, because they don't like the word psychic. There's all kinds of baggage that comes with that word, and if there was a better word to use, I'd be happy to use it. But if I used it, most people wouldn't understand what I'm talking about, because we've been trained in our society to respond to the word psychic and understand what that means. And so, it's, in fact, the person who invented it likes to say it's not being psychic, it's just another form of consciousness. So you could say we're studying consciousness, we're applying consciousness, but then people are going to come back and say, well, what are you talking about? I don't know what you mean by applying consciousness. I apply consciousness every day when I think about something or when I see a red rose or whatever. And so, hence, I default to psychic because everybody knows what that means.
Okay. All right. Now, I have been through a remote viewing course, but I only went through lesson one. Now, the reason that I only went through lesson one is because at the end of lesson one, you go through an actual remote viewing session, and I nailed it. And there were things about nailing it that I would say, I've been told, I use the term, it frightened me. And I've been told that's not the correct term. I have to say it was unsettling for me, at least. Because I had absolutely, it's not that I disbelieved in remote viewing, I just had no confidence that I was going to be able to do this, and I nailed it. And it was very unsettling for me. Now, have you had other folks that have had a similar experience where they were unsettled by it?
Every once in a while I hear somebody, and I was going to say we have a technical term for that, it's called, you know, getting freaked out.
Yeah, I really was afraid that if I pursued this, and I have people that try to talk me out of this position all the time, but I was afraid if I pursued this that I would actually begin accessing information I'm not sure I really want to know.
Well, you know what happens is that oftentimes this is something that we've been taught you just can't do. Our current model of science, mainstream academia, doesn't believe that this can be done. It doesn't believe that you can perceive something that's hidden from you in the manner I described earlier. And so we've grown up with that, and we have the idea that the world's a nice, fixed, place where certain rules apply, and there's things you can do and there's things you can't do, and we're comfortable with that. But when you come up with something that breaks the rules, it is unsettling. All of a sudden, you can't trust what you believe the world to be at that point. And you sit there and think, well, if this is possible, what else is possible, and what is it going to mean, and how is it going to affect me? And it can be a bit frightening isn't quite the right word, but disturbing, maybe.
I prefer
to go back to the world as they knew it and leave that kind of thing alone.
With me, it's not so much that I want to go back to the world as I knew it.
Mm-hmm.
It's that I'm not sure I want to know more.
Well, the fact is, first of all, you can't go back to the world as you knew it, because now you do know something that you didn't know before.
Yeah.
But no, I understand that. It sounds like it's a bit of a worry about control. Can I really control this to do what I want to do and only what I want it to do?
That's it.
Or is it going to take over, and I'm going to experience things I'm not ready for or interested in? So.
That's it. You've described it. You hit the nail right on the head, and that's precisely the case. I had this conversation with my producer just before the show, and he has sort of pushed me, not pushed me, but, you know, sort of nudged me in the direction of, why don't you complete the course, you know, before, because I've had this conversation several times. But I'm not sure I'm ready for that yet. But you are proficient at this. You're an old hand at this. So since you were here last time, you've made some new discoveries and developments. So why don't we get into that? What's been happening with Paul Smith and remote viewing?
Wow. There's been a lot. I'll start off with the science part of it, because that in itself is quite interesting. I teach remote viewing. I teach in-house training. In fact, I was about to say, if you're going to learn remote viewing, maybe you ought to come take my class. It will be much less disturbing, I assure you.
All right. I'll take your word for that.
Okay. So, anyway, what happens when I teach these classes is, once we get to day four of the in-house part of the class, I do a demonstration session for all my students. In other words, I've been putting them through the ringer for the last 3 days, giving them targets, they're expected to perform. But on the fourth day, by the time they've been able to put everything together that I've taught them, then I want to show them, kind of turn the tables, allow them to put me through my paces in a way, you know, show them how a remote viewer with a lot of experience goes through the same process they've just learned. It's very informative to them. And they come up with a target. I don't know what the target is, so the conditions are the same for me as it is for them when they're doing it. And I will do a demonstration session. And in this particular one, they'd actually done it really good. It was double blind. They didn't even know what the target was. They picked a set of them, and then they had randomly selected one blindly and didn't know what target I was addressing. So they gave me the target. But before this happened, one of my students was an MD named Melvin Morse. Many of your listeners may know him. He was a pediatrician, but his specialty is children's near-death experiences, and he's written a number of best-selling books on that subject. And he decided to take my remote viewing class, and he was in the class, and he brought along with him a random event generator. Now, I don't know if you know anything about the Global Consciousness Project. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'll briefly sketch it out for the audience, because some of them may not understand. What a random event generator is this little device that creates a stream of random numbers, just arbitrary numbers, in an electronic setting. And the global... way back, I better back up even more, at a laboratory out in Princeton, they discovered that human intentionality, human minds, the focus of human attention, can cause these generators to go non-random, even if the person's like in another room or whatever, right?
All right.
If you focus the attention a certain way, which is really interesting. That's also kind of ESP, psychokinesis, perhaps, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the Global Consciousness Project discovered that if you had a random event generator running when there was some mass consciousness event, for example, all of the people focused on the 9/11 tragedy when that happened, right? When all of that, the attacks happened and all those people died and everybody's watching TV, that was a focused attention of many, 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 many people. The random event generators that were running at the time showed a dramatic effect. They went non-random because of this organized consciousness field. Well, anyway, they now marketed this, and you can get your own little random event generator and run it and see if you can affect it and all that kind of thing. Well, Melvin Morse brought one of these REGs with him. And when I'm about to do my experiment, he says, or my demonstration, remote viewing, he says, can I run this REG while you're doing your demo? And I said, sure. You know, I kind of shrugged my shoulders because I didn't think I'd have an effect. I mean, there was just me doing it. There wasn't a massed group of people, right? So I said, sure, go ahead, kind of waved him off. And so he went over in the corner out of my line of sight and set it up. And I completely forgot about it. I was over here working, and I completely forgot about the thing. And I wrap up the session, which actually turned out to be the, they had ended up giving me the Beijing Olympic Stadium. And I did actually a pretty decent job on it. I did a sketch that's fairly representative of it, although I didn't recognize it because I actually never saw it. I didn't watch the Olympics. And so I did a fairly good job of it. And just as I'm wrapping it up, Melvin's over there in the corner. He says, oh, wow, you got to come look at this. And I'm going, look at what? Because I'd forgotten he was even doing it. And he said, come over here, look at this. And so I go over and look. And the trace on the thing, in fact, had spiked out of, beyond statistical significance, out of randomicity, come back in and then gone back out, correlated with the appropriate parts of my remote viewing session. So I was quite startled by that. It looked like, in fact, this thing was detecting me picking up on the remote viewing signal line around the corner, you know, maybe 10, 15 feet away from it. That was pretty astonishing.
I'm not going to get into that yet, but that brings up a question that my producer asked, and we'll do that later. This was the first time, though, that you had experienced the random event generator detecting your remote viewing. Is that right?
That's the first time I ever had anything to do with a random event generator.
And what do you think about that?
Well, I thought it was quite interesting, and now I'll drop the other shoe. First of all, there's some implications here. If that thing really was, so to speak, detecting my connection with the signal line, then it could act as a further evidence that something really is going on with the remote viewing, first of all. Second of all, if it could be relied on, it might actually be an indicator of when a remote viewer was being more accurate than other times when he or she wasn't being as accurate, because that's a problem with remote viewing. Sometimes it's accurate and sometimes it isn't. And if you're doing an operational session, you don't know what the target is, it would be nice to know if the viewer's producing reasonably strong data, right? So In a way, it could presumably act as a remote viewing lie detector in a way, right? So all these wheels are turning. We're thinking, wow, we got to see if this really works. And so what we did was we set up an even bigger experiment, and we got it supported through the auspices of the International Remote Viewing Association, which I've talked about before. It's a nonprofit, and they were able to support some research, and we brought in some viewers. We brought in altogether 10 people to work on this experiment. Did it over the 7th and 8th of November, so about a month ago. And we ran 24 remote viewing sessions. We ran the REGs during that time. There's so much data that we haven't got it all crunched yet. We haven't even got a portion of it crunched. But just visual inspection showed, our hypothesis was that when a viewer was off, there wouldn't be very much correlation with the REG. And when a viewer was on, there would be a stronger correlation. And just from a visual inspection of the data, it looks like that hypothesis was borne out. It does look like that's what we turned up with. But it's going to take us probably a couple months to get through all that data, but it's a start of what something that may be very profound if it bears out where we think it's going to go.
Now I'll bring up this question. Yeah, now I want to bring up this question. Can a remote viewer tell if someone is remote viewing him or things around him?
Usually not. However, this thing actually may be kind of a breakthrough in that respect as well. if it can detect a remote viewer at the beginning end, maybe it can detect a remote viewer at the ending end. We don't know. That's another complete experiment we need to try. And I can see how we could do that. We could set it up where you would have, say, an object in a room that you wanted someone to remote view. You have the REG set up nearby and see if it correlates, if it goes non-random in correlation with the times when the remote viewer is attempting to access it. And if it does show that kind of correlation enough, you can do some interesting statistics on it, and it may end up turning out to be the case.
Well, that could then be a useful tool for counter-espionage, couldn't it? We have to take a break, and I'll let you comment on that when we come back. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we will return right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Paul Smith. He is one of the pioneers, one of the people that was right on the front end of remote viewing, and is the person who wrote the manual to teach remote viewing in the program that he was part of in the government, in the military. Paul, I mentioned that before we went away that this whole thing with the random event generator possibly could be used as sort of an alert, an alarm in counter-espionage, counter-intelligence operations so that they could know if someone was remote viewing. What do you think?
I think it could be. And when I say could be, it's speculative right now because we haven't tested it. But at least from what we know about it, it seems like it might be usable like that, and it's certainly worth looking into. In fact, I hadn't thought about doing that experiment until I talked to you on this show, so sometime down the road we may do that, and I'll get on and report to you what happened.
Outstanding. All right, now, I'm not sure... Really, I mean, I guess it could be useful to know if someone is remote viewing, but I don't really know that if I knew they were remote viewing, for instance, I'm having a meeting in an office, and our random event generator tells us someone, we have a remote viewing intruder. Really, I'm not sure what you could do that would deflect that. I mean, they're going to see and hear what they are going to see and hear.
Yeah, well, that is, of course, one issue. If you knew a remote viewer was there, what would you do? The best thing you could do is just cancel the meeting and go meet somewhere else. that's the whole issue with remote viewing. Assuming it really works, which, of course, I know that it does, but there's a lot of folks out there who right now don't know that, but they're interested, right? Assuming that really works, there's not really a whole lot you can do about it. We haven't come up with any way of stopping anybody from remote viewing anything. I mean, the only way to do it is stop them personally. And then, of course, you have to find them to do that, which is, of course, one of the big reasons why they kept the remote viewing program secret is because they didn't want the Soviets finding out who and where the remote viewers were, because the best solution to a remote viewer is to take them out. And, of course, none of us wanted that to happen.
Yeah, that can ruin your whole day right there.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So, anyway, yeah, it's an interesting question, and it's one of those kind of questions where we really have only kind of scratched the surface of it. There's so much, actually, to research. This one experiment that I just described is really the first one that IRV has ever done. And frankly, it's one of the few remote viewing experiments that have been done in the last 10 years.
Why is that?
A lot of science being done on it. Well, it's because the research establishment refuses to believe it exists. And this is one of my pet peeves. The funding available for for parapsychology research in general has continued to plummet over the past couple of decades. It's gotten less and less and less, even as some of the data is getting better and better. And it's because the skeptics have done such a good propaganda job of telling people that there's nothing to it. That's a bunch of baloney. There is plenty to parapsychology in general, and remote viewing in particular, but the skeptics have sold the press and the people the bill of goods. You talked about the CNN thing where you had,
Miles O'Brien, yeah.
Yeah, Miles O'Brien trying to present a straight-ahead, I didn't see it, but from your description, he's trying to present a straight-ahead investigation of the UFO phenomena that they were reporting on, and meanwhile you had the anchors bickering behind his back about it, right?
Oh yeah, chuckling, and it was like, and you believe this, huh? You know?
Yeah. See, that's how the press handles all of this.
Heads firmly in the atmosphere of methane.
I'm sorry?
They had their heads firmly implanted in the atmosphere of methane.
Oh, hey, that's pretty good. Anyway, really, they feel obligated to make fun of this stuff because they believe the skeptics that there's nothing to it. And, of course, the skeptics want to believe there's nothing to it because if parapsychology, if the various phenomena that are turn out to be real, it destroys their entire worldview because their worldview is what's technically called physicalism, which is that everything is physical or dependent on physical. And
also there are a lot of these folks have PhDs in pure fiction.
Well, no, they have some real PhDs, but they're all grounded in a very narrow metaphysics of the universe. The idea that the only thing that's around is physical or it's related to physical. And so consequently anything like remote viewing or out-of-body experience, or near-death experience, or psychokinesis, any of that stuff, that all has to be baloney because their rules say nothing like that can exist if the universe is physical.
And that's why I say those are PhDs based on pure fiction. If everything were physical, then their PhDs would be based on fact.
I see. Yeah, then let's say they're based on half fact, because there is a lot in the universe that is physical. Okay.
So they have half Puro PhDs.
Yeah, there you go.
Look, I'm also one of those guys with a DR dot, and so I'm not standing on the outside throwing rocks. I am standing on the inside throwing rocks, because... It's not a question of, for me, it's not a question of do you believe. It's not, this stuff doesn't call upon us to have an act of faith. It either exists or it doesn't.
Right, if, and there is tangible evidence that it does.
That's it. If the evidence says A, then it's A. If it says B, then it's B. And it just doesn't call upon anyone to believe anything. And I just really, Paul, get torqued by all the talk about, do you believe in UFOs? Do you believe in this? Do you believe in that? I just wish that the world itself would get real and ask itself, who cares what you believe? Whatever is real whether you believe it or not. And whatever is real...
That's absolutely true.
Yeah, whatever is unreal no matter how much you believe it. So what is. And, there's just overwhelming evidence from remote viewing professionals that this works. It's real. It's not 100%, and I want us to talk about that. Why isn't it?
Well, before I go there, can I make a quick blurb about websites so people can find out more about this?
Absolutely.
Okay. There's actually three I want to let people know about. The first one, if you're interested in the stuff I told you about the experiment, you can go to the International Remote Viewing Association website, and that's very simple. It's just four letters, IRVA, So IRVA, I-R-V-A, .org. And you go to the main page, and there's a little button up there you can click on. It says Research, and it'll give you at least the preliminaries. We're going to post more stuff on there in the next week or so, and then more as time goes on. So IRVA.org.
Okay.
Of course, then I have my own commercial outfit that helps pay the bills.
All right.
That's where you can find out about training and all that. And that's rviewer.com. That's the word viewer with an R in front of it, rviewer.com. And finally, something I'd like to talk about if we have time towards, a little bit later in the program. I also have a two-DVD disc dowsing training program.
Okay.
If you want to learn dowsing, they can go to my other site, learndowsing.com. That's the two words run together, learn dowsing, D-O-W-S-I-N-G. So learndowsing.com. And the first two sites, mine and the nonprofits, there's a ton of information on remote viewing there. Many things we won't even get to tonight are available there. And the Learn Dowsing site will give you the opportunity to learn about dowsing, which is another interesting ESP modality, if you will.
All right. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit tonight, too.
Yeah. Because I have to tell you, both the remote viewing and dowsing, we've had some very interesting turn of events since I last talked to you. In terms of actually making money with this stuff. You know, there's the old saying, if you're psychic, you can quench. Well, it turns out that some folks are getting that way using this stuff. It's pretty interesting.
All right, well, let's go back to why is remote viewing not 100% accurate? What's the deal with that?
Well, there are, of course, some things we just don't know about. We don't understand what makes it work exactly. We have some speculations, but we don't have any concrete evidence. So we don't know exactly how it works. We just know what you have to do to make it work as often as possible. And so some of the things that seem to affect it, we don't understand. But there are some things we do understand. One of the problems is what we call mental noise or analytical overlay. The idea is that whenever you have a very, very subtle signal, which is what you're getting with remote viewing or any kind of ESP, there's all of this racket that's going on in all of our heads at one time or another all the time. Memories and thoughts and speculations and guesses and whatever, you know, that's all going on, and that can tend to give you a high signal-to-noise ratio. And if you know that if you have a very weak radio signal, this usually works in AM better than it does FM, but if you have a very weak radio signal, you can just barely hear it, and there's all this static, it's very hard to hear what's being said. That can be a problem with remote viewing. And so quite frequently, viewers will end up with the wrong, they make a guess about what it is they're getting, and they end up with the wrong data. That's what part of my training program, in fact, a large part of my training program is aimed at, to teach you how to be able to sort out that all the noise from the little bit of signal that comes in so that you can, in a way, kind of amplify the information you're getting and have an accurate experience.
All right, so that then leads me to this question. If we've got... let's say we have 100 people doing remote viewing at the same time, and then the signal to noise ratio is X. Tomorrow we have 10,000 people doing remote viewing at the same time. Does the signal to noise ratio change because there are more people?
No. The signal to noise ratio stays the same, you know, as far as we know, right? But what happens is now of course part of it is, are we talking about people who are just like kind of novice remote viewers, not really ever learned how to do it?
I'm just talking about around the world, because these certainly are, we have no control over how many people are remote viewing right now. So
now that won't affect it. It's the phenomenon itself, we think, is a, for want of a better term, it's a non-local phenomenon, which it's kind of like, you know, where digital, you can have all kinds of digital signals in the same space.
Okay.
It seems to act like that. It doesn't seem to matter how many or how few remote viewers are on the line, so to speak. It's not like the old party lines, you know, in the old telephone days. It's more like a digital spread spectrum kind of a effect. Even though neither one of those are really good ways of talking about it, because that's all, I assume, is electromagnetic and all that, and that isn't really how this works. We know it's not electromagnetic. But anyway, what happens is, okay, so let's say if you, actually your question is interesting, push it in a different way.
All right, give it some thought. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to hear the thought that you were about to tell us. We'll be back, folks, right after this, so don't go away, all right? And we are back. It's the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest is Paul Smith. We're talking about remote viewing. Paul, you had something on your mind, and we had to take a break. I want to give you a shot at it.
Yeah, the idea of having a bunch of remote viewers remote view something. There's different views on how what an impact that might make. But one of the things... that's one way around the noise, signal to noise problem. It turns out that if you have a whole bunch of people remote viewing something, the more you add, the better your chances are that you're going to get at least some kind of accurate result. Because what you do is you take all of the responses from everybody, and then you throw them all together, and the responses that... turn out to be reported by the most people have a high likelihood of being true.
So it's kind of a majority thing.
Yeah, in a way. Now, we're talking here about novice viewers, people who've never done it before. there's an experiment done actually by one of my friends but competitors, Lynn Buchanan, who it was over in Ireland, I guess it was. He was on a radio show, and they were going to predict the outcome of some soccer game, I think. I don't remember the exact details. At any rate, the way he does the same, well, we all do have the same, do this process called associative remote viewing, which I want to explain right now. But the idea was that if one team was going to win, they would play one sound on the radio, a sound of a sizzling steak. And if the other team was going to win, excuse me, then they would ring a bell, okay? And so they said, okay, all you listeners out there, email us or call us and tell us what sound you think you're going to hear in 3 days, whenever the game was going to be over. And so they all called in, and I think it was running about 10 to 1, something like that, sizzling, right?
Okay.
And sure enough, when the game was played, the team that was represented by the sizzling sound ended up being the actual victor in that match. So... and, of course, they didn't tell them which team it was because you don't want people just analyzing it from what they know about sports events, right? You want to actually just be a clean test.
So they were just deciding who's going to win, the sizzle or the bell ring.
That's right. And it turned out being accurate. I had something similar. I did an ARV. I was out at the University of Colorado doing a presentation on remote viewing to it's called the Edges of Science class, where they kind of study parapsychology, the pros and the cons, and the skeptics and the researchers and all that. And they asked me to come and give a presentation, so I did. And I had them do an associative remote viewing, an ARV. And it was I think it was Atlanta versus Chicago, may have been the game, basketball game. And... I had worked them through the remote viewing process. Most of them had never done it before. When we got done, we predicted 12-5 that Atlanta was going to win, if I'm remembering this all correctly. And sure enough, Atlanta won. So it shows that you can, a certain number, the larger the number, oftentimes the more precise the result, the more powerful the result, right? Now, of course, we're not talking here about very refined describing all the details of the inside of a structure. That's something you need a trained remote viewer to do. But in this kind of a setting, large numbers help, which is interesting because that class went on, and kind of using what I taught them very briefly, they were running an experiment, a couple of them, and they're using associative remote viewing, and one of them happened to be a fairly well... healed. He was sitting in on the class, and he'd made a lot of money in the IT world. And so they started with $10,000, and they're doing this experiment, and they do five iterations. They were right five times based on some fund they were buying or selling, right? And when they finished after those five times, they had that $10,000 had grown to $26,000.
So they actually have used remote viewing to make money.
Yes, and they did. They more than doubled their money in just five sessions, right? Which is pretty good. Now, I teach a class on associative remote viewing, and so I've had a lot of people come through and take it, and some of them have succeeded, some of them haven't. In fact, I've had one of my students who then, of course, you know, they say, well, if you're so good, why don't you win the lottery, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, she did. She won the Texas Pick 3 twice in 15 tries, which is just unimaginable statistics. That you can, because you should, in theory, win it once in 1,000 times, the way it's set up. Of course, this is a three-digit lottery. You don't make a lot of money on it. You get $1,000 bucks if you win it. But in the statistics are, you should get it once in 1,000 times. To get it twice in 15 tries is really just mind-boggling. And in the process of doing that, she got two digits in the correct order out of the three 8 times. So I can imagine she's pretty frustrated in hitting that those two and not the third one, you know, 8 times. So,
but, well, now let me ask you this.
It does work.
Huh? Let's say, and I'm asking because I don't know, let's say that I provided long lats, okay, longitude, latitude.
Right.
I give you nothing else. Would remote viewing enable the person to describe not only what's there, but any significant event that is taking place there?
Well, that's taking place currently there?
We'll say that has taken place within, say, the last 60 days.
In principle, you can do that, and it has been done, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
What your chances are, I don't know, somewhere between 60% and maybe 80% that you're going to do evidence, show evidence you actually describe the target. You get it probably of that about 50 to 60% of the time you might actually get some really good strong evidence or strong report and details. So you're talking 30% of the time you may be able to do a pretty decent job on that if you have a trained remote viewer who's got a lot of experience. And what I'm saying is 30% of the time you're going to get a highly accurate, detailed response. 60% of the time to 70% of the time you're going to have evidence that they actually did describe the target.
All right. What would happen if you had multiples, for instance, 5, 8, 10, 12, longitude, latitude, where it is known that the same event happened at all of these, and you're trying to determine what is that event?
Well, that's, of course, quite a bit more complicated. The first one is fairly complicated. To get a really good cut, you probably want to run three viewers on it. You want to make sure your tasking is very carefully done. It's not something that you just do like a parlor game, and that's what people think. Remote viewing, you just sit down and think about it, and the answer's there. That's not how it works.
Yeah, I know.
You have to conduct it like a carefully organized science experiment to make sure that your data is authentic. And so you have to put it together, create a tasking, make sure the tasking is correctly organized and put together, then have the viewer run on it. And usually, and you probably want three viewers to work that same thing. Now, there's some discussion about whether adding more viewers increases the chances of accuracy. Sometimes it doesn't, but quite often it does. So we won't worry about that at this point. But now, if you had, say, a dozen such targets around the world, you just multiply what I just said by about a dozen times.
So it really would not improve accuracy. You would have the same odds for each one individually.
Well, yeah, that's about how it works out. It's kind of like a coin toss. You know,
mm-hmm.
Coin toss is an individual event. Well, each remote viewing project would be an individual remote viewing project. And but you know, when you're talking 30% highly accurate, then of those 12 targets, you could count on at least four of them being very accurate representations of what actually happened there. And you might even get better than that. It depends partly on how good your viewers are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've got some really good viewers and they're having a good day, you could get, I mean, conceivably it's possible to get highly accurate results from all 12 targets. But it is a pretty time-consuming and energy-consuming kind of a process.
All right. Now, we've got a break coming up here in about a minute. All right. So let me ask this quickly. When remote viewers view something that seems to them to be bizarre, do they discard that?
They're not supposed to. You are supposed to report everything you perceive. It's not up to you to judge whether it's accurate or anything. You receive it, you perceive it, you put it down in your session transcript. You report everything. It's like the motto of the air defense artillery. When you're trying to decide whether what you're shooting as a friend or a foe, their motto is you shoot them all down and sort them out on the ground.
All righty then. I've heard it said this way: shoot them all and let God sort it out.
Yeah, it's the same principle.
Yeah. Okay. So if you're remote viewing something and you are detecting something that to you seems to be bizarre, you report it anyway. All right, folks. We'll take this break. When we come back, we'll open the telephone lines for you. And we'll invite you to call in with your questions or comments for Paul Smith right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Paul Smith, and we are talking with him about remote viewing. Remote viewing is something a lot of people have a lot of interest in, and I get a lot of email from folks saying, why don't you do another show on remote viewing? Okay, we're doing that. And the telephone line is open for you now. The telephone line is 602-539-9580. 602-539-9580. If you live outside of the United States or you live outside of Canada and you don't want to pay that international telephone call, you can use our flash message. Now, the flash message is email. Understand, I can't reply to it via email because it doesn't collect your email address. It collects your name and what country you're from and what your message is. But you can send me a flash message. Just go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, scroll down, and when you scroll down, you'll see the blurb about tonight's show. At the bottom of that is a link that says flash message. And you can use that. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, hello. It's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario.
Okay, Kevin. Speak right into your phone and it's a go.
My question there for Paul Smith. There's been a lot of problems with the player tonight.
The JetCast player?
Pardon?
The JetCast player?
Yeah, it cuts out every 60 seconds.
Yeah, JetCast is having a problem. I would suggest if that's not working, use the other one.
Well, Mr. Paul Smith, I wanted to know, have you ever heard of Dane Spots and his SciTech International Remote Viewing School?
Yeah, that used to belong to Ed Dames. It was Ed Dames' SciTech company, which Dame started. I actually was there at the original founding meeting of that in, I want to say, 1989, maybe. It was founded in Ed Dames' living room in Severn, Maryland, just down the road from Fort Meade. And he and I and I think Dave Morehouse was there and Mel Riley and maybe Lynn Buchanan got together, and Dames decided to form this company, and we worked for him for a while. and he went on to, of course, fame and fortune with SciTech. The Last of Us, which was me, left him in 1997, and he went on and was on, of course, Coast to Coast and predicted all kinds of things. And ultimately, however, he got crosswise with his girlfriend at the time, Joni Dourif, who there was some legal action involved, and Joni ended up marrying Dane Spots, and Ed Dames ended up losing the company, and so it became Dane Spots' remote viewing company. So that's a very brief nutshell history of it.
Wow. Yeah, because I heard DaneSpotsRemoteViewing.com, and the courses that he offers on there are very, very, very good courses on remote viewing. I've done remote viewing like an amateur way, but I know how to do it. I've done it before. But I've actually been wondering what your opinion was on if you have ever heard of SciTech International, if it was a good school for remote viewing and whatnot. So.
Well, I guess you get down to it, you're asking me about one of my competitors, and of course my inclination is to tell you, oh, you don't want to go with them. If you really want to learn remote viewing, you want to come with me. I don't know if you want to consider what I have to say objective about it. I do have an opinion. I think I've got the best course in the entire community, but it also is much more demanding than the rest of them. It's 5 days long and costs you $2,000, but you have 40 hours of remote viewing training. You do more sessions than you do with anybody else. You get a lecture from Hal Puthoff, the guy who founded the original CIA program. I don't want to go on too much. It'll sound like an infomercial, but the fact is, I think I've got the best training program in the entire remote viewing community, and a lot of folks say the same thing. You know, people who take,
and what's your website?
Who take other people's courses say the same thing. So that's the best I can tell you about that.
Yeah, Kevin, what did you say?
Do you have a website?
Yeah, what's the website for that, Paul?
My website?
Yeah.
It, of course, the three W's and dot, and then R Viewer. That's the R and then the word viewer, letter R, viewer.com.
All right, Kevin, thanks for the call.
Hey, Ann, thanks for the opportunity to get in a plug.
Well, you know, there's no way for us to know unless somebody tells us. And so, you know, you have that course, you have that school, and who knows best about it than you? Who would know better than you about your school? When you were saying Hal Puthoff does a lecture in this school, he is legendary. And I guess everyone knows Hal Puthoff. They know the name. And so he's associated with your school.
Well, no, he just very graciously agrees to give a lecture. Now, I pay him for his time, but he doesn't have to do that. In fact, he could command a whole lot more money than I'm able to pay him to do that. But he does it because he wants to kind of help people continue to understand remote viewing. He gives a lecture on the early days of remote viewing and kind of the science behind it. And all my students tell me that's one of the highlights of the course. They come and listen to Hal Puthoff show them and tell them about the things they did. It's very, very powerful. And he's a great guy. Hal's a wonderful guy. He's very even-keeled. He doesn't make all kinds of grandiose claims like you hear from some of the folks out there. And he just presents the facts and lets you make your own decision about him. He's wonderful.
What is the benefit of remote viewing? If you got someone listening right now and they're hearing about remote viewing and they're asking themselves, what would be the benefit to me? What would be your answer?
Well, of course, that's the old question, why learn remote viewing? And the answer I give is kind of like free fall parachute jumping, right?
All right.
You can use parachute jumping for practical things. And I'll show you the parallel here with remote viewing in a second. You can use parachute jumping for practical things. You can use it to jump in the water and rescue people. You can use it to get supplies to stranded folks. You can use it to get oak jumpers in, put out a forest fire. You can use it to get paratroopers in behind enemy lines to win a battle. But by far, most people who do it in the United States do it just for fun, right? They do it, and when I say for fun, it's actually more than that. It's, what it does is it shows that you are able to do things that the average human can't. It shows that you are more than who you might have thought you were. You know, here's something that takes a lot of courage, it takes a lot of energy, and all of a sudden you succeed at doing it. And that's kind of the way it is with remote viewing. It can be used, although not as much as we would like today because most people still don't believe in it. Most police departments don't, whatever. You can use it to help solve crimes. You can use it to help learn things about different things you might not know about. You can use it to find missing kids, whatever. And some will come to you can use it for investments, as I talked about. Some people do that. Take it for that. But I would say most people who come and take remote viewing do it to prove to themselves that they really are something more than just what the skeptics think we are, is meat machines, right? They show that we really are more than our physical bodies, that we really are able to transcend the universe in certain very meaningful ways. And it's really interesting. I watch my students, and when they finally have a success at it, it's just like their eyes open. They go, holy cow, it really does work, you know? And they have these kind of epiphanies it's to some degree life-changing. In fact, I like to joke, I have to be careful or they're going to make me get a therapist license here. You know? Because it can be very profoundly life-changing.
Let's go back to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling? Hello, caller.
Hello.
You're on the air. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, my name is Mark.
Hi, Mark. And you're calling from where?
I'm calling from California.
All right, Mark.
My question to Paul simply is as far as remote viewing people goes, can you remote somebody who has passed away, let's say like Napoleon, when he got himself stuck in Russia, in the middle of a winter storm, can you remote view what he was thinking or feeling at that time?
Well, that's a good question. It's possible, I think. One of the things we used to do at Fort Meade when we'd go out and explore enemy targets, right? You might be, a research facility in the Soviet Union, and the U.S. intelligence establishment didn't know what was going on in the research facility. And so they target us remote viewers on it. And one of the techniques we used to use is the monitor would say, okay, find somebody here at this facility. And we'd go and we'd go around and we'd find somebody, maybe they're in a lab jacket or wearing a hard hat or something. And then we would be asked by the monitor to say, okay, place this question to this person. Show me what it is that you do here, or show me what it is that this facility is for. And then you would oftentimes get actually accurate information. Sometimes it would be like, well, he's showing me that he turns these knobs and does this kind of thing, but sometimes you get even more useful information than that. And we never knew for sure if it was really like we were reading the guy's mind or if there really was this mental conversation going on. It could have been just a what you might call a heuristic device, a kind of a technique to help you understand or interpret things, help your subconscious access more of the data that you need, and it's kind of what they used to call a conceit or whatever, you know, just a trick, right? Or maybe we really were getting into that person's mind, okay? If that latter is correct, then, in fact, you could do that with Napoleon. You certainly can remote view a location and a time in the past and come back with accurate information about it. We've done it numerous times. One time, in fact, I had the skeptic... kind of skeptical major. He was an operations officer at one of the joint task forces, and we were going to do counter-narcotics ops for him. But he wasn't sure he believed this stuff really worked. And so he sits me down at the table, and he says, okay, I need to have a better feel for this. I have a target that I wrote on a piece of paper and folded it over about 50 times, and it's in my pocket here, so there's no way you can see it, and I want you to remote view what it is that I have the target. And so I just went through my process. I didn't even look at him. I didn't even bother looking at him. I was focused more on the paper and the pen in front of me and what I was trying to perceive. And I started describing this kind of rolling hills, kind of low, grassy kind of terrain. It was kind of foggy, and there was sun peeking through. And there were all these people running around the landscape, and they seemed to be dressed in very kind of crude clothing, kind of like animal skins and that kind of thing. And they had very crude weapons, and they were kind of attacking each other and beating each other up, right? And I'm reporting all this stuff verbally as I'm perceiving it and writing it down. And he says, okay, that's good enough. I say, well, I'm still working. He said, no, that's good enough. I'm persuaded. I said, well, why? And he said, he pulled out the paper and he handed it to me, and I unfolded it about 15 times. And right there, the target was the Battle of Hastings, 1066. And I'm absolutely convinced I was remote viewing the Battle of Hastings, because I had no idea what he intended as a target. He conveyed no information to me, and yet it came through quite clearly as I just described it. So it could be possible to remote view Napoleon. And then, in addition, you could, if this other technique really is reading people's minds, you could then presumably get his intentionality, you could get what he's thinking, some of his mental contents, and kind of get a feel for that. So, I'm sorry, that was a long answer for your question, but...
Mark, is this the first time you've called us?
Yes.
Well, I want to congratulate you and welcome you aboard. I hope you'll tune in every night and call us again.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. All right, folks, the telephone line is open for you, and as well, the flash message line for those of you who are outside of the United States, you're outside of Canada, you don't want to make that international telephone call, you can send me a flash message. If you're in the United States or Canada, use the phone, 602-539-9580. Now, I have recently gotten a couple of emails where folks have asked, well, if I want to make that call, and I live, you know, on the other side of the planet, but I want to make the call, will the phone number work? Yes, it will. But, you know, if you want to avoid paying for that international call, you can use that flash message, and I'll be glad to take a look at it. All right, and I'll read it on the air, and we'll ask Paul to comment on it if that's what you've asked for. All right, Paul, what would you say is probably the most unrealistic expectation new remote viewers have when they come to you?
Well, now that is a question no one has ever asked, and it's an excellent question. I'm glad you asked that. I think the most unrealistic expectations are into is people think that because it's called remote viewing, you really are going to get a very clear, sharp image of what the target is. It does not work that way.
Mm-hmm.
The misunderstanding that, unfortunately, I don't blame people for having that understanding, because the way it has been represented in the press and amongst some of the folks who get on the radio and talk about it, is that you're going to get some real clear, sharp image. It isn't. In fact, if you get a clear, sharp image, that's usually wrong. You have to learn, because that's usually a left brain construct. Your left brain builds this image out of the data and creates this whole, you know, kind of crystal palace out of it that isn't the actual target. That's part of the mental noise, and you have to learn to be able to see through that to get to the actual data, which is much fainter and much more subtle. I would say that's the number one biggest mistake people make, is to expect to have this very clear, sharp picture. It just doesn't work that way. And in fact, very seldom. Every once in a while, some ESP modality, someone will rarely have that kind of experience. Even in remote viewing, you might. But across the board, it's not just remote viewing, it's all these other modalities as well. It's only a rare experience that it's that clear and sharp. Usually, it's fuzzy, it comes in fragmented, and you have to learn how to perceive it in a certain way. There's a real art to it. So that's a great question.
You know, in that one session that I did that I told you was unsettling, there was a split second where I felt almost as if I had been transported to a location, just a split second, where I was sitting in a field with grass that was blowing, tall grass that was blowing, just a split second. But most of it was shapes, geometric shapes. And I kept I won't give away the punchline on this because there are people who may have not been through that first session and they've just purchased that set. But I kept seeing a pyramid shape or a triangle shape, and I thought that, you know, that just doesn't fit here. And I put it over on the side. You know, I recorded it, but I thought it was noise. As it turns out, that shape was prominently in the target. There were shapes. I can't say that there were sensations, but there were shapes. The sense of, never mind. I don't want to give it away. You're right. It's not like watching a movie. All right, caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, good evening. This is Kevin from Northern Alberta calling.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi. I wanted to ask...
Kevin's Northern Alberta.
I'm sorry, what'd you say, Paul?
Remote view into the future?
Can you remote view into the future, Paul?
You can. But it's not quite as... let me first say, I said, how many Kevins are there out there? That's what I said.
Oh, bunches. Bunches of us.
Yeah. In fact, I think I told you that my brother is Kevin Smith. He lives up in Anderson, Nevada.
Oh, is that right?
Yep. So, anyway, remote view through the future. Yes, you can do that. First of all, remote viewing an open-ended kind of a target in the future doesn't work nearly as well as your people claim it does. What I mean by that is, when and where is the next terrorist attack going to be? Or where, I don't know, what's some other future thing people want to know? Will I become rich in the future? I don't know. Those are open-ended. I call them open-ended. And those you are very unlikely to have a good success with. And it has to do with the nature of time. The future, of course, hasn't happened yet. It's just a whole bunch of braided possibilities out there. And what part of the future gets activated depends on what particular decision nodes are tripped in the meantime. So, for example, the example I always like to use, if I walk out the front door of my house and get my car and drive off and whatever, my timeline continues, and however I'm going to affect the world will continue to happen. If I walk out my back door, maybe I'll get hit by a meteor coming in, you know, crash, and I'm squished, right? And then whatever way I might have impacted the world doesn't happen, right? Well, that decision node, whether I go out the front door or the back door, determines what's going to happen in the future, right? So, at least as far as my part of the timeline. If you consider the timeline as literally millions or billions or even an infinite number of these different decision things happening overall, you can see why it can be very difficult to predict what's going to happen in the future. Now, there, of course, are some things that are more predictable than others because there are certain... I get real technical here, but I'm going to try and make this quick. There are certain deterministic things, effects here in the present, that are going to determine how certain things are going to happen in the future. Those are more easy to predict. So what it means is trying to predict the future is a mixed bag. Sometimes you're right, more often you're going to be wrong. And in fact, the two things people want you to do if they find out you're psychic is predict the future or find something's missing. Both of those are very hard to do. Predicting the future, everybody thinks that's what a psychic does, but in fact, you only hear about the successes. You don't hear about the 10 times as many number of failures. And so it really doesn't work as well as you think, except for one exception. I talked about associative remote viewing before, and that's a form where, you know, Lynn Buchanan's having people listen to sizzling steak or ringing bells. My student that won the lottery, of course, was predict future using associative remote viewing. Associative remote viewing is a very special kind of remote viewing that effectively collapses those possible futures into a certainty or near certainty in one small corner of the time stream. And in that case, you can actually predict the future in a limited way between 70 and 80% of the time, when it should only be 50%. That's pretty darn good.
All right, Kevin, you have another question?
I didn't confuse anybody. All right, well, he sort of answered. I guess he couldn't give me a definite outcome of this, the end of the Mayan calendar, then. It'd be more guesswork
no.
thing, I suppose.
No, and in fact, I have to tell you, I don't actually put much stock in that. I think that a lot of people are going to be disappointed when December 31st, 2012 comes along and nothing really has happened that is outside the normal course of things. If you actually look at what the Mayan calendar says, it doesn't actually say the world is going to end or anything like that. It does predict the new epoch occurring. And if you could think about this like the age of Aquarius, Kevin and I are of a certain age. We remember when there was all this super
I hate to do it. We're into a break. We'll have to finish that when we come back. Okay. Kevin, thanks for the call. Folks, we have to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to address some of your emails that I've been getting where you say, the phone's not working, please fix it. It is working. It needs no fixing. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Paul Smith. Very quickly, let me address a couple of emails that came in that were handed to me, and they say, oh, I've been trying to call for weeks and I can't get through, and I get these tones, and then it says your call cannot be completed at this time. Please get this fixed. Well, there's no fixing to it. The way it works, there's no fixing because it's not broke. The way it works is when your call comes in, the first call in gets put on hold, okay? The next call in gets put on hold, and the first one comes online. The third call and the fourth call get sent to voicemail, and then more calls after that, it's full, and it just says it can't be completed at this time. You're calling at a time when many others are already in. And that's just the nature of the game. If it was a dead show, we wouldn't have that situation. You could get me first time every time. But that's why there's a redial button on your phone, and I recommend you make use of it. It's a good one. It's a good button to have on your phone. You just keep hitting redial, and you'll get through eventually. All right? All right, now let's go to flash messages, and let's see, this one from Peter in Australia, and it says, can you boost the volume a bit? No, I can't. It is where it is, and if we go any higher than that, it rejects it. So as some of you may know, we have left Mogulus. Mogulus is in our rearview mirror now. And so now we're at Ustream. That may not be our permanent home, but with the system that we're having to work with, that's you're getting all the volume out of it we can put into it, all right? Let's see. From Australia. Also, this is a question for you, Paul. And it says, do you think UFOs sometimes are a visual representation of a mental connection between two or more people? Now, the reason I ask this is that me and my friend both saw a UFO from opposite sides of a city at the same time. It occurred to me that the sighting, I'm not sure I understand this. It occurred to me that the sighting represented a mental connection between us. Does he see this sort of a connection to UFOs? So what do you think, Paul?
Well, nobody's ever asked me that question before. anything is possible. Well, I won't say anything. There are some things that are not, but in general, something like that could be possible unless we can find something that would rule it out. I'm inclined to think it's more likely to be a real sighting of some kind rather than some kind of sort of telepathic connection, but mm-hmm. I suppose it's possible.
All right, and I have some questions along that line as well. The telephone line is open. For those of you who have been complaining it doesn't work, I'd suggest you hit redial. Makes a lot of sense to me. but and we'd love to hear from you. But unless you hit redial, it's not going to happen.
And you probably have to hit redial a number of times, probably, I would guess, probably to get through. It's kind of like trying to like win the contest on the radio station. One dial isn't going to be enough. If you want to be the seventh caller, you've got to keep hitting that thing. Right?
Well, that's true. And then what happens is I say something like that, and then a bunch of people do it, and then what happens is what I described.
Nobody gets through.
Well, the first one gets through, the second one gets put on hold, third and fourth get voicemail, and then the others get what they were getting, which is you can't get through. That's what happens when a phone is busy. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Paul in Los Angeles.
Okay, Paul in Los Angeles, what's on your mind?
Well, first of all, I was one of those people complaining about the phone.
It worked, though, didn't it? It worked,
and
though.
And I have been hitting redial for a long time.
And you finally got through.
It's kind of lame, I think, that you don't get a busy signal, that you get this, your call cannot be completed. I think a busy signal is the appropriate thing. But
well,
anyway,
I think you should talk with the phone company about that. I have no control over that. What's on your mind?
Okay, I won't. Anyway, I read Paul's book, Reading the Enemy's Mind.
All right.
And I thought it was an extremely well-written book and extremely interesting. But I just have a problem with the scientific aspects of it. I think that Paul was kind of stretching the science a bit, and I'd like to have him address that.
Okay, be specific. Stretching the science in what way?
Well, all the examples that he gave of the research that was done, I thought was pretty ambiguous. I thought that it could have just been left to chance. In fact, most of the examples that he gave in terms of percentages seemed to fall behind 50-50 in many cases. And even in the few cases he gave where it was a little bit better than 50-50, that itself was just left to chance. And I'd like to hear him address that.
All right.
The first thing you have to realize when you're talking statistics is that very seldom is it ever a 50-50 proposition. Usually it's more like 5% versus 95% that it ought to be successful. And of course, that's statistical significance. So, for example, in a lot of the SRI remote viewing experiments, what they did was they pulled the targets out of a data pool, pulled them randomly out. They were done blind. And then for the judging, they had one, and I'm just kind of shooting off the cuff here. I don't know exactly the numbers here, but they would, for example, have a set of targets, like five targets, five possible targets, only one of which was the real target. And when then a blind judge comes in and they give them the transcript and they say, okay, which one of these does this transcript fit? And the judge has access to no other information other than what's in the target. And if he, let's say, picks the correct target based on the transcript, then that's really a 1 out of 5 chance, which is much less than 50-50. That's 20%. That's 1 out of, well, it's 1 out of 5 rather than 1 out of 2. And so that, you do that enough times, the statistics get very powerful. And, in fact, they did do that at SRI. They had some really incredible statistics based on those kinds of blind judging scenarios. Okay. Now, when you do an associative remote viewing, it is 50-50. That's what chance is. You know, if you were just going to guess whether, I'll use the example I did before, whether Atlanta or Chicago is going to win the basketball game, if you're just going to guess, then over a long string of guesses, it's going to come out 50%. You'll be wrong 50% of the time. You'll be right 50% of the time. But if you actually get it right 60% of the time, if you do say 100 of these things and you end up with 60 times you're right and only 40 times you're wrong, that starts to get very interesting. And when you do that 1,000 times, the statistics get very powerful. Now, if you're doing better than that, if you're doing 80% of the time, then they get powerful a lot quicker. So that's really, when we're talking statistics, what's happening. It's usually not a 50-50 proposition, and in those cases where it is, they do it a lot of times, right? Now, as far as the, you run into this issue, the skeptics will often say, well, there's one skeptic particularly, probably the most prominent one too, a guy named Ray Hyman. He's very respected. He kind of makes it a no-win situation. He says, first of all, what he calls prima facie evidence is not sufficient to prove a claim about being psychic. Prima facie evidence is where you have a remote viewing result that is just obviously of the target. Like if the target's the Eiffel Tower, somebody draws a picture of the Eiffel Tower and says the target's the Eiffel Tower, that is prima facie evidence that the remote viewing was successful. The problem is you can't analyze that statistically. Okay, so he says prima facie evidence isn't sufficient. Okay, but then what he says is parapsychology is the only science that relies exclusively on statistics to prove its point. Well, so what he's saying is you can't count the statistics and you can't count the prima facie evidence. What can you count? You know. So I'm sorry, that's a soapbox. That's not a direct answer to your question. But anyway, part of the problem with the book is I couldn't actually show most of that stuff. If you saw a lot of that, a lot of what was done, you would see that some of that stuff is very, very strikingly good. It's just amazing. And it's done double blind. The protocols are very carefully done, double blind, double blind judge and all that. You can, though, on my website see some of the examples of the sessions I did in my training. And you can see some of them are very bad. I put all of them up there, the warts and the beautiful ones as well. Some of them are very bad, but there are a number of them that are very impressive as well, and you can kind of see what kind of results you get. So, I don't know. Let me throw it back to you, Paul, and is there more you'd like to ask about that?
I have to admit that I had a really hard time hearing about 85% of what you said. I was getting dropouts. I don't know if Kevin was hearing those same dropouts. But,
no. No dropouts here. Okay. No dropouts on the audio. It was fine.
Yeah, so it must be in the stream somewhere.
Yeah. All right, Paul, thank you for your call, and I'm glad you finally got through.
Wait a second. Kevin, is it possible, is this going to be archived? Is it possible to listen to it after the fact?
Oh, sure. Every show.
Paul, you may try that. What's that?
Yeah, I'll listen to the archive. Is there a way I could contact Paul after I listen to that?
Paul, is there a way on your website to be contacted?
Yeah, go to my website, and if you click on contact, it'll take you to an info site. You can email me, and I'll get those emails.
Okay, so you just check on his site, and you'll be able to contact him from there.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, as for it being lame that you don't get a busy signal, you get told the call can't be completed. What does it matter? I mean, whether it goes bzz, 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 or says, sorry, we can't do this right now. Anyway, thanks for the call. And I have no control over what it tells you when the telephone system is full. I do not own that company. I've gotten a couple of emails from folks, I'm sorry, flash messages from folks who are in the United States. Please understand, if you're in the United States, we don't read those flash messages on the air. We ask that you use the telephone number. It is, after all, a TALK talk show. 602-539-9580. Paul, you were about to say something.
Yeah, I'd like to take a minute or two and talk about the dowsing, because there's been some interesting things happen there.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, we're only 10 seconds away from break, so less than 10. So let's get to that when we come back from this break that we have just jumped off into. All right, folks, we'll be back right after this, more with Paul Smith here at The Kevin Smith Show. are back. This is the Kevin Smith Show. We're on final approach for this evening, meaning that we have about 10 minutes left until the end of the show. Paul, you wanted to get into talking about dowsing.
Yeah, I thought some folks might find that interesting, because it also is valuable, too. Remote viewing can be useful, not to mention the fact that I got into that it's also kind of self-fulfilling, but it can also be useful. Dowsing, of course, can in some ways be more useful than remote viewing. Of course, this is a conjunction. I mentioned my site about dowsing, learndowsing.com, so I thought I'd bring that up again. We actually have had, a while back, I don't remember if I talked about this on the last show I was with you, but I keep getting reports from folks that are using my my dowsing training set, and reports that they've actually had successes with this. Had one guy back then who had actually won $18,000 in the lottery using my dowsing set, and I'm wishing that I'd had that same success.
Oh, yeah, that'd be fine, wouldn't it?
It would, but he actually since has called me, and although in this case I can't report money in the bank, it was intriguing. He's up in Alaska, and his girlfriend was in Utah and buying lottery tickets in Idaho, so we got this tri-state kind of thing, which messed it up. But he was using the principles taught in my dowsing set. He was up in Alaska, and he got these two times he got. It was Powerball or something. I don't really understand how Powerball works, but I think he got everything but the Powerball, or he got three numbers and the Powerball or something like that. At any rate, he gets the numbers. He feels very strongly that they're right. He forwards them to his girlfriend and asks her to go buy the tickets, and she was having some serious medical issues could not make it up to Idaho to get the tickets. And so he finds out after the fact that she didn't get the tickets, and then he sees the outcome of the lottery. He would have won $100,000.
I guess he was a little disappointed.
He was quite disappointed. But the other side of that, of course, is now he's got more incentive to try again, you know, and come back from Alaska so he can buy the tickets itself. But it's interesting. That of course, is a fun story, and may induce people to be interested in buying or in getting involved in dowsing and perhaps getting my set just to learn that. But more interesting is the fact that dowsing is another modality that actually can be very valuable, particularly when we're dealing in times as we are now, where you know people are losing their jobs, the whole economy's kind of melted down and such, making decisions now becomes important, and dowsing actually is very helpful in decision making. You can obviously you don't want to use it as a substitute for good hard analysis and knowing all the facts, but when quite frequently the decisions we come to are such that we know all the facts that there are to know, but there are things we just can't know. It's impossible to know in advance. And so we need some way of breaking a tie in some decisions and stuff. And dowsing, in a way, can do that. Because what happens is, unlike the way dowsing used to be thought of, that it was some kind of magical force that was moving the dowsing implement, whether it's a Y rod or an L rod or a pendulum or whatever, we now pretty well understand that the subconscious is actually communicating through that, just like a meter on a dial, the pointer on a needle moves to show you what the value is in a dial of some sort. In this case, say if you're holding a pendulum, your subconscious is actually talking through your subconscious muscle movements to indicate yes or no or whatever. And so just like in remote viewing, subconscious is the key element to what's producing the data, producing and understanding it. That's what's connected with the rest of the universe and is providing us the information. Dowsing is a different way of getting information out in a way that avoids mental noise as well. And so it's certainly a skill that can be cultivated, and it's one that can be valuable, particularly in uncertain times. You know, obviously you want to make your decisions based on as much information as you can get, but dowsing can actually help move you past that. To the point where you don't have enough information, it can help you make better decisions, better choices. So I just wanted to put in that blurb for dowsing. And, of course, you can learn about it if you want by going to learndowsing.com. So
You know, I have been familiar with dowsing primarily for things like locating water or locating ley lines, things like that. But I have not been exposed to dowsing as a decision maker or as an aid to making decisions. How can that help you make decisions? I mean, how does dowsing work to do that?
Well, you can use it actually in a number of different ways. Now, obviously, the classical example is the old prospector out looking for water with his forked stick, right?
Yeah.
But when we were at Fort Meade, we developed the use of dowsing to try and locate things. I said a while back that the two hardest things to do are predict the future and find something that's missing, and those are the two things that most people want you to do when they find out you're psychic. Remote viewing, although people talk about using it to find missing kids and all that, and I just even used that example earlier, doesn't work all that well. It's better than nothing. When you haven't got anything else, it's better than nothing, but it doesn't work all that well because what it doesn't help you find something, it doesn't help you locate it. You can describe the setting of the things missing, but unless somebody recognizes a setting, it's usually the case that you're not going to find whatever you're looking for, right? With dowsing, it's kind of the other way around. You know what you're looking for, you don't know where it is, and if you have like a map or something,
okay,
use dowsing to locate on the map where the thing is that you're looking for, the person or the object or whatever. You can use it also to make decisions in the same way, because then a map, all a map is a diagram. So you can make a diagram that has, say, yes or no, right, and then you learn, you have to learn the task, and you have to task it properly. You have to be very specific and very unambiguous, or you're likely to get the wrong answer. You make a very specific task, and you say, okay, for example, should I, I don't know, this is a kind of a bad example. Let's say, shall I take this job or not, let's say, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then with a pendulum, oftentimes, the pendulum, if you do it properly, is going to indicate yes or no. And if you have no other means of making a decision than that, that can be a decision. And, in fact, more times you'll be right more times than wrong if you're doing it properly. So you can use it in that sense to make a decision. We actually used it oftentimes. We would douse diagrams of, for example, we're trying to apprehend contraband-carrying ships in the Caribbean, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You might have a matrix that is kind of a fan diagram, and it was cocaine, heroin, marijuana, you know, all the different kinds of things that could be on a smuggler ship, right?
Okay.
And we'd use the pendulum to tell us what was on that ship, and quite frequently it worked. So,
does it work often enough to statistically be above a guess?
People who get practiced enough at it, I believe that it does. Now, I've seen it work. We don't have time for me to tell you a couple of the stories where it actually worked, and we were able to actually recover contraband and arrest narco traffickers based on dowsing and remote viewing information, but we did succeed in doing that. And maybe next time I'm on, I can go into more details on that.
All right.
But, yeah.
Now, you had several websites to tell us the address of. I'd like for you to repeat those for us so that people will know how to get in touch with you.
Okay, excellent. Well, the first one, of course, has to do with the experiment we did under the Remote Viewing Association, the nonprofit. And so that website is a nonprofit one, and I'll tell you that. That's irva.org, so irva.org. And if you're interested in the research, that's a good place to go. The next one is my commercial remote viewing training site, which is rviewer, that's rviewer.com, so viewer with an R in front of it, .com. And then the one that I was just talking about is learndowsing.com, the two words learn and dowsing put together. Or if you search for dowsing and Paul Smith, you'll get it.
All right. Paul, stay on the line with me for a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a wrap. We've come to the end of another Kevin Smith Show. So, I'll tell you what. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.